We're glad you're joining us here at Common Thread Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts. So today's lesson is giving up on sugar daddy religion, fixing that part of our broken religion. Now, every week of this lesson so far, I've started with a story based on how people have responded to a question that I've been asking. What is it that you hate about religion? Well, today's story is my own. I went through almost a decade of depression in my 20s. Now, some of that depression was fuzzy enough that I was just thinking, you know, it's probably I'm just burned out. That's probably what's going on. But it crystallized for me, whoa, this is depression, at a church service that I attended when I was in graduate school. Now, the speaker had gone to Biafra during the famines and the war of the late 60s, the early 70s, and he'd stayed. And he stayed to try and establish famine-proof infrastructures in a part of the world that is the most famine-prone that there is. Now, I've lived overseas, and so I know how far a U.S. dollar will go in other parts of the world. And consequently, at that point in my life, I had been giving away 20% of my income for years. But I was a starving student, so it wasn't very much money. But he was there to raise money, and I knew he was there to raise money, so I went. And I am sure he made a great presentation, but I will never know, because he told a story. And that story unraveled me. That story is still inside of me, defining the terms of my spiritual life. Well, in this Biafran village that he worked with, the working age men had left home to go find work so that they could send home money to their families so their families could eat. But war, but famine. And so turning their labor into food at home, it wasn't working. Now, this was a Christian village, so the old folks and the women and the kids, they'd gather every day to pray. And they would beseech God to save them from their troubles. And there was a detail as he was telling this story that really stuck with me, because they were praying a prayer that I had prayed myself. It was a prayer taken from David's words in Psalm 37. They rephrased those words as a promise from God. The words say, I have been young, I have been old, that's what David wrote, and I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his children begging for bread. Well, they adapted those words the way that I had adapted those words and was praying, Dear God, we are young and we are old and we need this divine promise to be fulfilled. So we stand on that promise and we hold you to your promise. May we not be forsaken and may we be provided our daily bread. And then, the speaker said, the whole village died, every last one of them, of starvation. Righteous and forsaken and begging for bread. Now, I think I can piece together today what the speaker was trying to say. He's probably trying to say something like, we are, every one of us, carriers of the inner divine, which means if we don't arise to care for the vulnerable, to care for the hungry, there will be no care. I bet that's what he was trying to say. That's not what I heard. Because I'd grown up in that American dream version of religion that I mentioned earlier. But his story, it didn't work in my version of religion. What it did instead was confirm a religious unraveling that had been going on inside of me for a while. Really, it was an unraveling of my whole version of self. Because who am I if the universe isn't how I thought the universe was? Who am I if God isn't the way I thought God was? Now, I had grown up in a pretty common version of American Christianity, a version that had been shaped a lot by American history, and one of the features of our history is our economics. Now, we've become keenly aware of late how many Americans have been excluded from economic access and from economic opportunity in our nation. We have become keenly aware of how unjustly our prosperity was built, how unequally, even cruelly. But as a global event, America has seen 400 years of unparalleled economic growth. And for most of our history, each generation has grown accustomed to being more prosperous than the last, which has made it a very common American experience to have troubles, but then overcome them. We have troubles, sure we do. But given years of the economic trend lines, it's kind of in our collective experience that, things get sorted out. Problems, they get solved. Now, again, many Americans have been excluded from those trend lines, but many have family stories to tell. It was bad. Oh, it was really, really bad. But then we did this thing, or we did that thing, and it got better. I grew up with family stories like that. And when we tell those stories, we tend to point to this thing or that thing, and we say to one another, that thing is what really saved us. Which may have been true, partly, because when we tell those stories, we don't usually include the story about the economic trend lines, which also are true. My grandfather was a smart man. My grandfather did work very hard. And he did start with nothing right after World War II, and he built a chain of grocery stores. But also, Los Angeles in the 40s and the 50s had all the right economic trend lines. And so when my family tells those stories and told them to me when I was a very young boy, we never said that. No, we just pointed to smart and to hard work, which is, again, true, partly. But some of our stories aren't even partly true. They are correlation, not causation. Things go well, and while they are going well, we are doing this thing or this other thing. They both happened, but maybe not related to one another at all. Or maybe they are related to each other, but not in the way that we think they are. Well, my religion did that. This thing happened, and we attributed it to that thing. Now, I didn't learn until later that theology folks have a word for what my religion was doing. They call it triumphalism. But what we were doing is working the same faulty principle that we saw the Pharisees working last week. If we do this thing God asks of us, we will triumph. Yes, we have troubles. Yes, we have problems. But if we do this thing, this religious thing, then God will intervene and will fix what is broken and will solve what is painful, will give us what we need. Now, it's not the way that it works, but it is a compelling story. If we tell that story of a deal that we make with God, we will do this, then God will do that. It gives us a sense of agency in our lives. It's not what Jesus taught. It's pretty hard to square that version of religion with take up your cross and follow me. But we Americans might can be forgiven. And if you're not from the South, that's a Southern thing. Might can, might could, might should. And I think everybody should talk that way. But anyway, we might can be forgiven for falling into this illusion because economic trend lines. Oh, I guess this is how religion works. You got to forgive the preacher who's living in the culture, who stands up and says that stuff, because he's probably thinking, yeah, this is the way religion works. It's an easy mistake to make. Now, there isn't time to fully develop this right now, but it is notable that those who were excluded from economic access, they don't tend to fall for this heresy. They tend to see, oh yeah, Jesus was talking to the folks who were suffering under the injustice of imperial dominance. If you're interested, you can read up on liberation theology. That'll help you kind of understand that perspective, that framework. But here's the thing about these deals that we strike with God, where he will be the sugar daddy God that we would like. It is not uncommon, in fact, it's most common, that the problems that we want our religion to solve for us are false self problems. Because the false self is where most of our pain comes from anyway, so it makes sense that that's the deal that we would strike with God. My core false self fear, that's what we want solved. Now mine is being weak, being vulnerable. I never saw myself doing this, but I've always arranged my life so that I don't feel those feelings. Now if you've studied the Enneagram, you could have a pretty good guess at what my personality type is. And for me, once I figured out that religion was a deal that we strike with God, I will do X, God will do Y. Once I figured out that that's what religion was, well, I did all the X's, and I did them fiercely. What I wanted from God was power and control so that I didn't have to feel vulnerable. Consequently, I was devout, and I sacrificed, and I was studious. I fasted, I prayed. I didn't make my standard of piety my peers in church. They were slackers in my mind. My standard was history. I went back to try and figure out who the stars had been, and then I was going to do whatever they did. I'm going to make damn sure that God never forsakes me, and that I'm not out there begging for bread. I'm going to be God's man of faith and power. Now, it's honestly a little embarrassing to say that out loud. When I was writing it, I thought, oh, God, am I actually going to say that? But that's what the false self does. We say it all the time. When our truths are not true enough, we suffer the consequences no matter how firmly we believe what we believe. And my religion and my identity as super devout religious guy, now it was already unraveling before I heard that speaker from Biafra, but that story broke the dike. I didn't know that there was going to be a healthy religion on the other side. Making the deal was the only religion that I knew. I thought everything was going to go down the tubes. But when we practice let's make a deal religion, when we practice sugar daddy religion, what we bargain for is usually determined by our personalities. Now again, my personalities disposed me to bargain for power so that I didn't have to feel weak. Others bargain for safety and security. Still others bargain for safety, for worth, for value, for esteem. Whatever our core personality fear is, without realizing that we're doing it, we just tend to tune in to whatever part of religion will ease that core fear. But again, if our truths aren't true enough, no amount of passion or devotion or commitment to that truth is going to end well. And oh, our false self fears, they just feel so true. A religion that would mitigate those fears feels so powerful. But alas. Now again, we can be forgiven. Remember, unparalleled economic expansion. It sure did seem for decades and decades, for centuries, that it worked that way. But we can also be forgiven because it is also kind of true that healthy religion will actually make our lives better. That's why we work the circle, right? It has been powerfully transformative in my life, and I know for you too. But it's the underlying framework that we're talking about. And that underlying framework really matters if we want a religion that has the legs to go the distance. Religion doesn't make our lives better in a bargain with God, sugar daddy kind of way. When it makes our lives better, it's more of a helping us align better with things as things are kind of way. For example, we talk a lot about oneness, the oneness with the interior light, the oneness that we have with one another. When we align our lives and our practices with that deeper reality, sure enough, life does start going better. When we do spiritual practices that help us align with deeper reality, yeah, it does go better. But before I was able to do that or access that religion, I had to first begin to deconstruct my inherited bargain with God kind of religion. And I tell you, those instincts, they run very deep. I had to make a fierce commitment to the deconstruction because I'd made such a fierce commitment to doing the right things and believing the right things. So it was hard work, it was emotional work, all of that deconstructing of my religious narrative. And honestly, I'd never have done it if my broken religion had just kept working. It just didn't. And I know lots of you, it hasn't worked for you either. Truths that aren't true enough, they always let us down. And when they do, a lot of folks just walk out the door and never come back. Also, When we find out that our truths aren't true, it hurts. One woman told me when I asked her about what she hated about religion, that when her religion stopped working for her, she felt deeply betrayed, and she felt lied to by the people who had perpetrated those truths that turned out to be not true enough. She told me I'd had this very nice worldview where my superhuman God controlled all the variables in the universe and kept me safe. And I did everything that he asked me to do. That was the deal. But then, she said, a long time of infertility. Then, she said, decades of my mother's chronic illness. Then, she said, my children bullied mercilessly. And finally, after years of God not keeping up his end of the deal, why not bail out? Now, she said some beautiful things about the permission that she found here to both deconstruct and reconstruct religion. That's what we're going to be talking about next week. But if God is not our sugar daddy, if religion is not a cosmic bargain that we strike, then what is it? Again, that's what we'll talk about next week. But for today, here's what it is. It's beautiful. It is a process by which we are deeply altered. The very self that we define ourselves as being, that we think really is us, that turns out to be no, just our shadow selves, our false selves, that gets deconstructed. When Jesus talks about taking up our cross, he's talking about death, and it's death to a version of self. But it is a self that never was true enough anyway. And so that happens, but then there is a rebirth, a resurrection to life, a deeper self, a more authentic self. And that's what healthy religion does. It awakens us to the possibility that we can live from that interior light, and we can do it steadily through our lives. We don't have to be limited to those little snatches and glimpses that we get of the higher life. No, we can live in oneness with the interior light, with the inner divine. When we fix our broken religion, that's what it does for us, and it is a beautiful thing. It's why I've given my life to religion. I think it's worth the hard work of repairing what we've broken, fixing what we've broken. And so, inner divine in each of us, finding our way past these limiting stories that we tell ourselves, and in particular this one, but also all the other stories that keep us from having access to the interior divine, the inner light that's in each one of us. That's our prayer. That's our desire. Amen. Well, I'm a little late updating you on Scott's monthly finance report. This is all the way back for August. And in his email that came out a while ago, Scott told us that there was a dip in August. We were down almost $5,000 from budget. But he told us year to date we're still ahead. Some of that income that kept us ahead was given toward our In It Together fund to help people through the pandemic. But also, we've been spending less. So he tells us we're in decent financial shape, but we don't want August to become a trend. Also in his email, he talked about his own gratitude for our community during these crazy days. He said that what has kept him in balance and what has helped him healthy and growing are the spiritual skills and practices that we work on together. And when he said that, it sounded to me like he was echoing something that I say on a regular basis. Spiritual community is a good place to invest. There are solid returns on our time and our energy and our love and on the dollars that it takes to make it all work. We all donate online now, and so you'll find the options on our website under the donate button there at the top of the page. And that being said, what are you thinking about? What is stirring up in your heart? Gene, what have folks been saying in the comments section?
So we'll hang in here for a minute.
You sound like you're in a cave.
There we go. So Rebecca over here.
Hello,
says,
Rebecca.
In my family, those stories always end in, "But God saw us through," in quotes.
Right.
Which sounds really nice, but left me wondering, why us? Why not others?
Yeah. Yeah, so when this thing breaks down, it's usually when we get a bigger version of us. One of the primary things that happens is when we say, we Christians, or we in this denomination, or we white people or we white Christians, we get the benefits of God. And when you start to realize, you know, the divine is a universal reality for all, and then you start to think the us-them construct breaks down, and then things exactly like you brought up, Rebecca, yeah, that comes out, and we think, yeah, well, why? Why are we in? Are we on, you know, if when we still have the afterlife story of a heaven to gain and a hell to shun, why do we get the one and the other? Or why do we get the blessings of God and others not? And you begin to realize, yeah, that's probably not the right story. Yeah. Which is too bad because they are beautiful stories. What else?
So there was a series of comments. So Tina Clyburn says, in my work, we say true but partial.
Right.
Ange Sokoli says, do you think denominations are tied to specific and different deals we make with God?
Mm-hmm.
Different versions of true or not so true.
Mm-hmm.
I said, alternative truth. Sarah Milke says, alternative truth sounds very Orwellian. And then someplace in there, Scott Shackleton said, since there are about 43,000 Protestant denominations, that's a whole lot of deal making. One of them might even say the art of the deal. But... you know, what's true?
Oh, you're so funny, Scott.
But what's true? You know, who's truth?
So, I wrote a book, by the way. In Rethinking Our Story, I talk about shifting from the Newtonian worldview to the quantum worldview. And when we do that, we move from a solid universe to a relative universe to an illusory universe. And when that happens, something happens in each one of our social institutions. And in religion, some of our core framing constructs have to get reconfigured. When we lived in the Newtonian worldview, it made so much sense for our core doctrine to be the atonement. Now, that's a theological word. You don't need to know it. What it means is, what have I got to do to make sure that I get saved by God? Really, that I get to heaven or I get the blessings of God. What do I have to do? What's the right thing? What's the good thing? Because when the world is a solid, confident, certitude-driven place, being right is really important. And then we move over to this world now that's about paradox. And the best truths are usually the ones that travel in mutually exclusively, exclusive-seeming binary truths. And so how do we do that there? Well, here the core doctrine is how you get saved. Here the core doctrine, and here again another theological term, is the ineffability of the divine, or the uncontainable nature of God, or the transcendence of God. It's what we say all the time. God is just a code word for that which we cannot contain, that which is greater and bigger than we can pin down into a story or a box or a belief. Well, when we live in the realm of the uncontainable reality of the divine, those 43,000 Protestant denominations that all decided, we have the one and true truth, you think differently, so we can't go to church with you anymore. Maybe after only 5,000 times, maybe 10,000, we might could have caught on to the concept that maybe that's not the way the world works. Maybe that's not the way truth is. Maybe that's not how we ought to be approaching this. We ought to maybe look about the experience of this uncontainable reality as opposed to getting our doctrine about this uncontainable reality right. And that's what is happening right now in this current Reformation that is being thrown in response to this current emerging worldview. We are having to think thoughts about how do you experience the divine rather than how do you define the rightness of your belief about the divine. And so doctrine is becoming a lot less important and experience a lot more. Our spiritual practices are a lot less about studying to make sure we got it right and meditating to make sure we can experience, or resolving conflict so we can experience it, or self-awareness, or the things that we see showing up in the circle. So, yes, truth that is variable depending upon where you're standing when you experience it is kind of the way the world is, we now understand. So how do you be a religion when that's the case? And it turns out there's a great way to be a religion, and we'll talk about that next week. Well, if you would, please put your hands on your heart and let us, as we go, remember together that we are all, every one of us, carriers of the indwelling divine. Love and joy, peace, goodness, kindness, they are within us. And if you would extend your other hand to our city, and let's look for opportunities to share what is in us with those that we live and work and go to school with, looking for opportunities to repair and heal our worlds. Amen. God bless you. We're dismissed. Love one another as you go, which might mean head on over to the Zoom chat. Make sure your kids head to their Zoom chats. See you next week. If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, commonthreadchurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page for your computer's browser, at the bottom of the page for your phones.